This is a Pinball News production.
Thanks for joining us here at the Southern Fried Gamer Expo. Now, my name is Nate Shivers. I host a pinball podcast called Coast to Coast Pinball, and I am lucky enough to moderate this fireside chat style talk here with Jerry Stellenberg from P3 Multimorphic, P-Rock. I think you're trying to save the world on some level, too.
No,
you're not doing that? Okay. So we're at a great time in pinball. Obviously, pinball is evolving. We're seeing the rise in popularity. We got crowds out here. The tournament's packed. There's new games that are, some of them are coming out, some of them are not. It's an interesting time. And over the last few years, I've had the enjoyment to watch the P3 platform and Lexi Lightspeed sort of evolve into where it is now. And who in the room's played, and I know a lot of you guys are sort of close to the project, who's played Lexi Lightspeed? All right, well, if you haven't played the game we're going to be talking about here today, I encourage you to stop by. It's outside the game room on the right, the free play room, and play Lexi Lightspeed. But Jerry and I are going to kind of talk about how we got there, what it is, what the future for it is. We'll take questions at the end and hopefully demystify a little bit of what this game is. It has this big, you know, screen in it. Is it a video game? Is it a pinball machine? Is it both? Is it the future? Is it too soon? I don't know. Let's talk about it. Thank you for coming out and joining us here, Jerry.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Okay, so let's kind of go all the way back. Let's start all the way back. Why'd you want to get into pinball? What brought you to that crazy idea?
So I used to, in college, I would go to the pool hall pretty much every day.
Where were you going to college?
Virginia Tech.
Virginia Tech, okay.
And a friend of mine played pinball all the time, so we would be waiting for a table to play pool, and he would go play pinball. And pinball's stupid. It's just, why would I go spend money and play for a minute or two? And anyway, he was playing Theater of Magic, and he was good, and he racked up a bunch of free credits. And we were waiting for a table. Like, Jerry, just go play my credits. So I walked over there, played through like 5 credits in less than 5 minutes, and was hooked. I wanted to play it more and more and more. So a couple years later, moved to Austin, Texas for a job and bought a Theater of Magic and an Attack from Mars, and just, you know how it goes.
You wanted to be a part of it even more so, yeah?
Yeah.
So what's your background? What do you work in? What was your job in?
Studied computer engineering in school, got hired by National Instruments right out of school in Austin. They do a lot of small circuit boards for communication protocols and things, and for test and measurement devices for engineers to use. And actually, it's funny, when I graduated school, the first thing I did before I even started the job was I called up the manager who hired me, and I asked him for one of his digital I.O. cards. And I took an old pinball playfield that I bought from some guy on campus, and I hooked up the playfield to this digital I.O. board. I programmed it in their programming language, LabVIEW, which is a graphical programming language. You literally pull icons around the screen and connect things. You can do for loops and while loops and things with graphics. And I got this pinball machine working in my apartment running on LabVIEW. It's kind of crazy. I wish I still had that thing, because now everything, I could show people the history of my involvement with custom pinball, but yeah.
When did you first decide you thought you could build a machine that not only was a pinball machine with flippers and pop bumpers, but also integrated something more modern, like an LCD screen?
I haven't decided that yet.
You haven't gotten there yet?
So it was 5 or 6 years ago. I had quit my job to start a new company. I had an idea, a concept I was researching and trying to get funding for, and I bought a few more machines, and I filled up my house with, geez, probably like every one of you, I filled up my house with a good 12 pinball machines. And I'd play them for a while, and I'd beat a few of them, and I don't know, every time I played them on, they're the same thing, and I literally got bored of playing these machines. And I'm an engineer, I wanted to start a company, so I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm always thinking about what I can do and how I can, you know, take technology and do new things, and trying to apply that into pinball, I came up with this concept to take pinball machines and turn them into platforms. So I had 12 machines. I could literally, if I designed the right circuit board, I could put it in the machine and turn that into a platform that I could change the software on and, you know, play it in different ways and just kind of take that thing. Kind of like Brida Pinbot 2 that you all see in the game room now, is now you boot it up and you can select 2 different software versions to play. That's what I wanted to do. So I created the P-Rock board. And that was the beginning of this whole journey through custom pinball.
What was the first use for a P-Rock board?
It was actually that. These guys from the Netherlands emailed me, and they heard about the board, and they wanted to customize that Bride of Pinbot game. So Barry and Koen from
Dutch Pinball.
From Dutch Pinball. Bought, I think they were the first real customer for that board.
So that was born out of fans of a game who loved the layout, loved the iconography, the art, everything about the game, but had become bored or, you know, tired of the rule set. And there's a lot of pinball machines where we say, oh, it's such a great game, it's so many good shots, but it's shallow. And so they decided to do something about it using your product.
Yeah, so my goal wasn't specifically to make shallow games deeper. It was just to provide some variety, to take this machine that I thought was kind of dead because I played through it and it's no longer exciting to me when I turn it on, but to give it more life and to create a product that anybody could use in any pinball machine and breathe new life into it.
Talking about the P-Rock board, how many games, whether it's homebrew, one-off games, or projects, would you say have been actually, you know, developed and designed around the P-Rock as the brain?
So, I mean, I could tell you how many boards we've sold, but I don't really know how many pinball machines people... The thing is, people have lofty expectations or hopes of themselves, and then life sets in. And
it's harder than they thought it would be?
Well, I don't know that it's harder, it just takes time. So people buy a board... They want to go customize a game, and they start playing around with the software, and they figure out how to do some basic things, and then they, you know, I don't know, they get a new job, or they get busy with life, they have a child, or, you know, move into a new house, or whatever, things happen, and they just kind of shelf the board, and some people never take that and develop a product on it. I know for sure there are a good 75 to 100 new either pinball machines or new software versions of games that they can run on existing pinball machines.
What was the design process when you sat down to really put something together from the ground up yourself with P3? And obviously P3 is more than just a pinball machine. It's a platform with swappable, you know, games. And even it goes even beyond that. It's a pretty deep thing that I personally think might be some of the trip-ups for you getting this thing off the ground and going, is it's not just,
not,
hey, it's a new game.
It's a video game.
Yeah, it's not a video game.
It's not a video game.
But there's a lot to it. Because yeah. you can view it as, hey, it's Lexi Lightspeed. Do I like this game? Or, hey, I can design back playfields and design my own game. There's a lot to this. So how was that process started, and where did you kind of, what was the drawing board like?
Yeah, so we had the P-Rock board at some point, and all these people were using it to create their games and their custom software. And we followed that on by developing driver boards and things they could fill out the control system. So somebody could now buy the P-Rock and our driver boards and soon-to-be switchboards and LED boards that they could go build a custom game with. And I wanted to show people what I thought you could do in a modern pinball machine with a modern control system. And my ideas, as we've talked about, are, you know, technology-based and forward-thinking. And I wanted to move the industry forward a little bit and, you know, apply new technology, change up gameplay characteristics a little bit, and bring new ideas and new designs potentially to the industry. So the first concept I had was to develop this mechanism where you could track the physical pinball as it rolled around the playfield. So if you knew at all times where that ball was, and you took that wooden playfield that sits underneath a ball that in, I don't know, the lower two-thirds of most games is simply a blank, well, not blank, it's a painted piece of wood with some blinking inserts.
Some inserts, yeah.
If we took that area and turned it into a dynamic, playable surface with an LCD or something like that, and we knew exactly where the ball was at all time, we could create this more immersive gaming system where the ball was interacting with the screen. This is also, I guess, the time, this was 2009, when I first developed the infrared grid, which is the technology we use to track the ball. That's right around when, Adam, you can tell me this, when did the iPad first come out? 2010. Okay, so, but the iPhone was around.
So you're saying Apple stole your idea? I like that.
No, I just said the next phrase to preclude that statement. The iPhone was already out, and all these, I don't know if Android was out then or not, but probably was. But there were touchscreen surfaces were starting to become popular, so just applying that technology into pinball made some sense in industry in general. There's a video I put out on YouTube. I think it's 2009. First got the P-Rock in, and I connected it to these handmade breadboarded boards with infrared emitters and detectors on them, and I lined them up on the sides of an LCD screen, and I drew lines between these virtual representations of the transmitters and receivers, and I wrote a very simple algorithm to try to figure out exactly where the ball would be if certain lines of light were broken. And there's a video in 2009 of me rolling a ball around on my kitchen table and showing a red dot under or somewhere close to that ball.
Okay, so explain it to me like I'm five. How is this screen tracking the ball?
Okay, so the screen is not a touchscreen. It's just a regular... It's a regular LCD screen, like a TV
like
or
a display monitor,
computer monitor.
Yep.
And then we built circuit boards that have infrared emitters and detectors. It's beams of light, invisible light. It's in the infrared spectrum that a five-year-old would have no idea what I'm talking about. So beams of light, and we have crisscrossed grids of these light going from a bunch of emitters to a bunch of detectors.
So those emitters and detectors are all there.
Of crisscrossed lines over top of the screen, and when the ball rolls on that screen or on a protected surface above that screen, it breaks beams of light.
It knows where the broken line beams
are. So all we do is say, when the ball's in this position, we know beams number 31, 32, and 33 are broken. That means the ball is...
So then you write software that can have the display react to the ball.
That's right. So we take that interpolated position, and then we draw a graphic right there. So we have a virtual representation of the ball, hopefully right underneath the physical ball, hopefully. In reality, that first thing, the resolution, the spacing between all the infrared emitters and detectors was about an inch, so the ball would kind of jump around, the virtual ball would jump around underneath the physical ball, but you could see it. I mean, you can all go to, I think it's still on YouTube, you can go see the video now, and you can see that ball just kind of jumping around very coarsely following the real physical pinball as we rolled around.
So the pitfall here, I think, in trying to do video with pinball is the purists, the people who are into the retro side of pinball are going to say, oh, it's, you're losing everything. It's not a physical game. And what I think is pretty brilliant about P3 is you didn't just put a screen in with maybe a few things on the sides. The back third of the play field is custom to the game and is also, you're able to swap it out when you have a new game, whereas the screen can stay in. The back third can have ramps, it can have targets and pop bumpers. Was that from the beginning? Did you have that design idea from the very start?
No, we wanted it to be physical. We wanted real ball, real flippers. I mean, what is pinball? We were joking around asking the question before the seminar, but what is pinball? And to me, pinball is physical pinball, physical flippers, physical targets you're shooting at that are scoring points or helping you progress through a game. Whether it's complicated things like ramps and loops and magnets and spinners, or it could be just targets and targets and targets and bumpers or whatever.
Sure.
But so definitely wanted the game to be physical. At first it was just going to be a kind of generic fan style layout that we could apply a bunch of different rules to and create interesting and hopefully semi-unique game applications on that
one
fixed
set
play field.
Sure.
And you know what? We built a prototype. This was back in March of 2012, which was right before the Texas Pinball Festival in 2012 when we first brought our early prototype of the P3. I had a party before that show so we could get people's feedback on it and test it and make sure we actually wanted to take this to a show. And some guy said, some random guy who we're not attributing this to, said, you know what would be really cool? If you could take that physical layout and change it. You can change the graphics, which is cool, but if you're always shooting at the same physical targets, it's still going to get boring. What if you could change that physical layout? And I'm like, no, that's too complicated. It's too much work. We're not going to do that. The next year when he came over and saw the machine, it was fully modular, and he could see that.
That's great.
Yeah.
Lexi Lightspeed, Galaxy Girl, has changed to Lexi Lightspeed, Galaxy Girl, Escape from Earth, I believe.
Yeah, we took out the word Galaxy Girl.
Galaxy Girl. So it's Lexi Lightspeed, Escape from Earth. there's a lot of design to this game. There's rules. There's things to shoot for. There's art. Who was the design team on Lexi Lightspeed?
The big name designer on the game was Dennis Nordman.
Yep.
So we knew for our first game, once we had decided this would be a real multi-game platform and we have all this technology in it and we want people to be able to play and enjoy it, we knew that it probably couldn't just be a bunch of us who have no experience designing pinball games, creating something and getting people excited about it. So we went out and found a big name designer. And the way we did that is we took one of our prototypes to Expo 2013. And I saw Dennis standing there with his... Actually, it was the first version of his Wonelli game was at that show.
Yeah.
And I introduced myself and then asked him to come look at my game. And he's probably like, oh, you're another guy who wants me to come see your brilliant playfield layout that really sucks.
Yeah.
But he walked over and he...
No, they're all actually really good. Don't listen to him.
He was intrigued by it. I don't know if he liked it or not. He's kind of a quiet guy, kind of hard to read sometimes, but... I asked him if he'd be interested in designing a game for it, and he said, absolutely, yes. So we started talking the next few months. We started talking about concepts, and he wanted to do an original game. I didn't have the money for a license, so we were able to talk through some ideas, and eventually we came up with Lexi. So it was Dennis Nordman who was the main designer, and then we have an artist who is a new guy that also we met at a show who had just graduated from art design for games. I don't know exactly what his degree was. I don't know how to phrase it. But he was an artist who studied game design in school, and he was interested, and he saw this ad. It was PPE 2013 also. He's like, if you ever need help, just call me up. I'm just starting out. I need to get experience. We're like, perfect. Here's a guy who will probably work for very cheap and is probably very moldable, and we can tell him exactly what we want, and I can kind of direct him to implement my vision. So we had an artist. We had a game designer. We went to the Northwest Show in Seattle 2013, same year, and met David Thiel, who's the audio guy who he's worked on, I think it's 24 pinball machines now, a lot for Stern. I think he's also working on The Hobbit now, and he's done a ton of games. And he said he wants to be a part of what he thinks will be the future of pinball. It's a huge compliment, but also this presence in the industry, this audio guy. I mean, there's only two or three audio guys people know about.
The people know by name, yeah.
In the pinball industry. So we had Dennis Nordman, we had David Thiel, who, by the way, I couldn't announce his name until recently because he didn't want to mess up his opportunity to work for people who would actually pay him.
Ah, money, yes.
And then we had Rory, who was our artist, and then me and another couple of people working on the hardware and software side. So it was a team of people with ideas, out-of-the-box thinking. People hadn't been in the pinball industry before but had ideas, and then it was people who knew what they were doing, and Dennis and David.
What's the reaction been like from people in the industry who, I don't know, I'm thinking folks like Roger Sharp, folks like other designers, people who've followed pinball for maybe decades. What has been the reaction when they actually play the game?
You know, those guys are hard to read because, I mean, they probably get tons of people walking up to him, just like I joked about with Dennis, saying, I have this awesome idea for a game. It's going to have three crisscrossing loop shots, and it's going to have a flipper up top that shoots the ball downwards or some crazy idea. And they don't want to crush people's dreams, so they're probably like, you know what, that sounds really neat. You should probably go prototype that and try it out and see if people like it. I don't know. We saw Roger Sharp at... When was Roger first playing the game? It was the same time Dennis saw the game.
Yep.
So at Expo 2013. Yep. And Roger played it, and he was intrigued by it. Michael Gottlieb played it. Michael Gottlieb and a couple other of the old-time designers who had been out of the industry for 20 or 30 years, just kind of walking through after their banquet, they played it. And just seeing the reaction on these guys, they weren't quite sure what to make of it because it is a huge video screen. At the time, actually, it was a smaller video screen. We have a 32-inch screen in there now. At that time, it was a 27-inch screen. Previously, our first prototype was a 22-inch screen, so that screen has grown over time. But, it's hard to read them. They're not going to come out and say it's, the best thing ever, and they're not going to say it's awful. So you just kind of watch them play it, and you try to figure out what they're thinking. He had great things to say. Roger talked like he really liked it, and he seemed to. But I started asking him ideas. Like, I don't know if you've seen the game, but if you haven't seen the game, when you go out there and play it, you'll notice that our scoreboard isn't on a display in the back box. It's on that LCD screen, but it's actually right below the flippers.
It's very centered, right below your face.
Yeah, so in the normal game, in a normal game, our game's normal, in a traditional game, the area right below the flippers is a physical drain. So the ball actually rolls through there and it drains, and you can't put a display or anything like that there. But in our game, what we did is we took that area, and because we have the LCD monitor there already, we opened up the playable surface. We created transparent ball guides that still create a drain down there, but we can actually see the display below there. And we put the scoreboard there, so when you're playing and you're looking at the flippers trying to keep the ball alive, you see all the time exactly what your score is. I proposed that idea to Roger, and Roger said that's a terrible idea. And didn't expound on that. I'm like,
just left you hanging with okay. Terrible idea.
Why do you think that's a terrible idea? And he said, because a lot of kids will walk up to the game and they're just a little bit higher, taller than the machine itself, and they won't be able to see that.
Interesting.
And it was a really good idea, but in practice, once we implemented it, it didn't turn out to be true, because the way the mechanics are set up right around there, you have a pretty shallow line of view, so it works out. The next year, I saw Roger, and I was like, well, there's the scoreboard right where you said not to put it. And he didn't say a word. He played the game for a good 15 or 20 minutes. Didn't say, I'm standing there waiting for it to break or to fix it or to answer questions. He didn't say a word and he walked away.
Talk about the flippers. The flippers are, I would say, to the casual player walks up to the game, and I get to hear some of their very candid responses at times, and I've talked to players about it.
I don't hear their candid responses.
No, you don't, I know. I'll give you notes for a small fee later. The flippers are the most important part, I think, in somebody's first impression of anything in pinball that's different or new. Mm-hmm. I mean, you even hear people say, I don't like Stern games because of the flippers, you know, real traditional pinball players. And now Stern's gone back to this other feel of flippers, and it's, oh, now I don't like those. So anytime you change flippers, I think you're walking a fine line. Your flipper assembly is incredibly unique because you have an LCD screen below the flipper mechanics. You can't drill holes through that LCD screen, so you had to come up with this floating flipper mechanism. So talk about the flipper design and how what the struggle's been like to get those to both work in your system and feel good, quote, to a traditional pinball player.
So you reminded me that also during this conversation with Roger and actually Michael Gottlieb and a couple of the other guys at that expo, where we had the 27-inch monitor, but we had traditional flippers, right? Because it was a smaller monitor, it was a little bit higher in the playfield. We had real flippers, we just had floating slingshots. And I told them all, I said, we're really thinking about making the monitor bigger, and that's why I talked to Roger about the putting the scoreboard down there. But I said, to do that, we're going to have to, you know, figure out how to float our flipper mechanisms just like we did with our slingshots. And Roger and Michael and all the guys were like, that's not a good idea. You want to take as many off-the-shelf components as you can possibly find and use them in your game and don't re-engineer basically anything. And so I took that advice and I completely ignored all of it. And I don't know, I feel like most of the designers who have been doing this for years and years and years, they've worked themselves into a box, and they design games a certain way, and pinball is to them what you see on the existing games. And I didn't want to be stuck with that. I wanted to keep the concepts that were cool, that I liked, that were physical. Flippers are a physical thing that define pinball, and you need to have flippers, but why can't they be different? So I went back home and talked to our main mechanical guy at the time. His name was Les Pitt, who had invented our floating slingshots. And I told him that we needed to float flipper mechanisms above the playfield. And he said, nope, can't do it. It's like, why not? We did it with the slingshots. Why can't we do it with the flippers? Because the flippers have so much more strength than the slingshots. They just flip them a couple times. In our first couple assemblies that we built, I forced him to try to do it. I mean, Martin probably remembers it shows in our early version of flippers, and they had little rods that were connecting the coils to the flipper mechanisms, and they looked really chintzy, and they were, and they would literally tear themselves apart. We managed, we'd go to these shows with these flipper assemblies that would barely hold together, and we'd be, you know, duct tape and bubble gum and trying to get them to stay working through a show. Because if the flippers break, you can't play the machine. You're kind of done. Everyone's going to walk away and go buy some machine based on a 60-year-old movie or something. I don't know. But so our flippers tore themselves apart for a couple years, and then we started beefing up all the assemblies. Now we have big, strong rods connecting them. The version we have in there are aluminum flipper bats that we milled out of solid aluminum. And the mechanism is now very simple. We use an existing Williams coil, an 11629 for people who know the numbers. We're using existing coil stop brackets. So go off the shelf to your favorite parts supplier and buy a coil bracket, and that's what we're using in our flipper assembly. So all we really have are custom flipper bats and a custom link that connects them to the coil. It's really taking that flipper mechanism that's below the playfield, turning it upside down, putting it above the playfield, and just changing just like two or three parts. So essentially, I can say in retrospect, we listened to all the advice. We didn't really change anything. We just made it look a little bit different.
Sure. Talk about the buttons. Each side of the machine has three buttons mm-hmm. instead of the single button we would be accustomed to seeing. What do those other buttons do? What's the future use idea?
So the way we designed our play field is with a rail system that sits on both sides of the play field that everything can slide into. So it's fully modular. But what that means is we have this rail that's 6 or 8 inches tall that sits way up against the outside edges of the cabinet. And if you're familiar with a traditional pinball machine, the buttons are, well, there's a hole that's cut into the cabinet wall, and the button is an inch or inch and a half deep, and it screws onto the outside of the cabinet, and the switch mechanism extends about an inch or so inside the cabinet. Well, we have a metal plate just inside that cabinet, so we have literally no room to put a switch. Yep. So we came up with this mechanism to allow us to move buttons a little bit outside the cabinet, and we call those button boxes. So when we created that mechanism, I think we were sitting in a meeting, and I proposed this idea, and all the other mechanical guys are like, why would you do that? Well, one, we had to move it out off the cabinet, but the concept of a button box where it's a separate detachable thing was just kind of an idea to make it easy to assemble at the time. But what we realized is it's just another piece of a hugely modular platform where we could take a different button configuration or a different input style and connect it to the machine. So we threw on three buttons just, I don't know, because. It seems like if you have a video screen, you need more buttons. I don't know.
Show off the potential.
Potential. So everyone walks up to the thing and asks, what do all these buttons do? And for a while, we'd sit there and explain it. And then we're like, hey, let's use this screen and actually put instructions on the screen and tell people, basically answer everyone's questions before they can ask us. Well, they still ask us what all the buttons do, but now we can point to the screen and say, well, there, it tells you. So the red ones are the flipper buttons, and the white ones and the yellow ones cycle through some little simple things, like you can change your active modes. In different games and in different modes, we could implement different kinds of things.
Yeah, like in Attack from Mars 2, you could have, you know, laser fights and stuff with the Martians.
Didn't Revenge from Mars, they allow you, using the secondary buttons, to move some targets around in the wizard mode?
I think you're correct.
Something like that. We don't really make use of them yet, but we have a lot of concepts for that. But the thing about the button boxes is you can pull off our button boxes and reattach things with gun handles, like a Demolition Man style interface where you have gun handles with buttons. Or you can take this thing and mount something that comes over the lockdown bar with a steering wheel for a driving game. You can literally change up the entire input system to your game. So what we've done is we've given game designers a way to
change the input,
change
from
whatever they want, but specifically input in this case.
Who do you think buys a P3 platform and game?
Everybody. So we've tried to solve a lot of what we consider the problems with the industry today. People who have 12 games in their house, I can say this from experience, are kind of nuts because the pinball machine takes over the house. But if you could have a modular system, well, what happened in the video game world? You don't go buy a big Pac-Man and a big Defender and a big whatever anymore. You go buy a video game console, which is a small box, and you stick it in your entertainment center, and you buy discs, or even now you can probably download a lot of the games for it. So you don't take any more space for more than one game. So people who one are out of space, can buy a P3, and it takes up one spot in their house, and then they can, as we develop more games for it, they can add games. And oh, by the way, we want to open the platform up so that third parties can develop games for it. Just like a Nintendo. Nintendo makes a console and they make some games for it, and then they allow other parties, EA Sports and whoever, to create games for it. That's what we want to do for the system. So essentially, if we can get enough of these games into people's homes and get other people to start making games for it, then it kind of feeds off itself and whatever. So we solved the what I call the floor space problem. We solved the price per game problem. And I kind of hesitate to say that because people laugh at me when I tell them the machine costs, you know, $10,000 or $8,000 or $9,000, depending on our final pricing, which we haven't quite finished yet. They laugh at me when I say that, but as soon as you buy two games from Stern or Jersey Jack or whoever, some of the boutique guys, it's $6,000 to $10,000 a piece. You buy two games, you're at, you know,
$12,000 to $20,000.
Buy three, you're at $18,000 to $30,000.
Yeah.
If you buy three games for the P3, say you bought the platform plus a game for $10,000 and another add-on module is $2,000, you've paid $12,000 for three games, which is significantly less than $18,000, and it also only took that one spot in your house. So we targeted, or we're targeting consumers, but we're also hoping to sell this to operators. We've solved a lot of the issues that we think plague operators, like serviceability. Our machine is so modular that if something breaks, you literally just, you know, pull the glass off, lift the playfield up, and pull components out. If your flipper assembly breaks, you pull the assembly out. You can work on it on your bench, or you can take it into your back office or your lab. Or I have a workbench in my garage where I can just take it and work on it and then fix it and stick it back in. Or I could go buy a replacement and pull the broken one out, stick the working one in, and we're good. So we think we've solved some issues that operators face. We think we've solved some issues that consumers face. So we think we can sell it to both. There's one more aspect to it, though, and because it's a multi-game system, we can experiment with other types of gameplay. So if, I don't know, I'm going to throw out Stern. I'm not trying to pick on them. I'm just using them as an example of someone who has a cabinet and a system that they use to build pinball machines. If they wanted to experiment with a new style of gameplay, they'd have to build everything, the cabinet and whatever the play field, and figure out how to manipulate their control system to control it. We can literally just design it's nearly 2 foot by 2 foot upper play field module with some kind of unique gameplay feature that may be completely different from a traditional pinball game. Maybe it's three holes and you're just trying to shoot the right hole. It may be a very simple thing. But we can go build that for pretty cheap and pretty quickly, toss it to the machine, take it to a Dave and Buster's and say, here's a Redemption-style game that's not pinball. It's something else that uses flippers and a ball, but it doesn't have deep rules and a story that you have to understand and all this stuff.
I think, too, that you know we see on the virtual platforms that there's a lot of these, you know, kind of lone wolf guys who design these games in their, you know, late night spare time, whatever it may be. And there's lots of those games, and there's a lot of pride taken into, you know, how accurately some of these guys will recreate existing machines into the virtual world. And some of the original things, I've had guys on my show that have designed games, and I think that could be one of the biggest markets for your product, is that guys that do want to design but maybe don't want to build a Whitewood and build this giant thing, they could take your existing back third and roll with that and design a whole game around that if they wanted to, just on the programming end. And
are you telling me I answered your question incorrectly?
Nope. I just had more ideas.
Gotcha. Thank you. Yeah. It's interesting to talk about the people who want to build their own games and customize games. And I mean, a lot of people talk very excitedly about the plans they have, and I'm sure some of them will actually, you know, execute those plans and create games. But it's hard to define a potential market based on what people say they want to do. And we've even found that with people who tell us what they think we should do for the game. We think the artwork should look like this, or we think you should change the rules and do this. And you know what? You go and implement the rules or the artwork that they wanted, and then they look at it. You know what? That just doesn't quite work. Because they're just guessing
like
we guessed when we started. Yeah. So we just kind of have to develop our own plan, figure out who we think is going to buy the machine, and go with that. And then we can branch out and do other people's ideas along the way, or they can implement their own ideas. But it's tough to, like I just said, build or make plans based on what people say they think they want to do.
Sure. Let's talk about the business of it all. Mm-hmm. I think that's a, you know, more so now than at any point in pinball. If you get in into the online pinball forums, and certainly with my show, it's one of the things that spikes my listenership. So when we start talking about, you know, new companies to the game and trying to get off the ground, trying to take money in, trying to ship a game, trying to build a game, it's tripping people up badly. And customers are, I think, probably nearing the end of the idea that they're going to finance the development for these companies, and you're sitting here with this game that's pretty much developed, ready to go. Where do you stand as a company in wanting to build this game and make production run, and what needs to happen for Multimorphic going forward?
Yeah, so this is the funding question. How do we develop, manufacture, and sell a pinball machine without significant support from whether it's customers or investors or whatever. We started with a very simple vision with no business plan. We slowly converted that to a business. And the main reason I converted the idea of the P3 and the prototype of a P3 into a business is because I had an aunt and uncle come visit my house and see the machine and force me to take their money. They said, you have to go, you've got something here. You have to go see what you can do with this. And it's not something I hadn't thought about, but it's not something I expected just to kind of drop itself on my doorstep. The flip side to that is that's pretty much the last money we ever saw come into the company. So we got this gift from friends and family. We call it friends and family investors. And we started the company. We hired a couple people. I paid myself for a little while. And then it became painfully clear that this money is good, but it's not going to get us anywhere close to production. That money ran out a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, and it's interesting to watch the industry and people take in pre-order money and use that to develop their games. And I mean, to me, that's just unethical, and I won't do it. I won't put other people's money at risk. I would actually rather go broke myself than to put other people's money at risk. And I'm kind of walking that walk because I'm not paying myself. I haven't been for the last 2 years. Most of our employees are volunteers, people we found at. Actually, most of them have come up to us at shows. They've seen the machine. They like what we're doing. They see the value in it. They see the potential in it. And they ask to get involved. And the first thing I say to all of them is, thank you for your support. I'm glad you're so enthusiastic. But here's the reality of it. I would love to accept your help, but I don't have money to pay you to help us. Like, that's cool. I just want to be a part of it. I think it's going to be potentially the future of pinball. I see where you're going with it, and I want to help. So we've built a team of people that are all volunteering. It still takes money to build prototype pinball machines. They're big, complex, mechanical things. And we're doing a lot of new custom assemblies and features. I'm staring at one of the guys who does a lot of the metal fabrication tray for us over on the side here. It costs money to do this stuff, so we're just figuring out how to go forward. We've pulled in a little bit more investor money, but nothing close to what we would need to go hire people full-time and go pay for a big license and, you know, do things like a real company would do things. We're all working out of our houses, making do with whatever tools we have. And
what are you telling people who come play the game and then turn to you and say, that's awesome, I want one?
I'm telling them 4 to 6 months from now, we think we'll be producing these games. So we're so committed, we're so far along the path that we know we're going to do whatever it takes to get this machine to production.
What's production mean? Does production mean a contract manufacturer? Does it mean you and your house building these one at a time? What's it look like?
So my experience is designing circuit boards for big companies, Cisco Systems and 3Com and Hewlett-Packard and those kind of systems or those kind of companies, where we take a design and work with a contract manufacturer, of which we're in Austin, Texas. There are hundreds of, we could literally walk down the street and talk to 25 different contract manufacturers. So they can build circuit boards, but we've gone and talked to a lot of them, and they have big space, and they build equipment, and they say they can build these complex pinball machines for us. But one of the things we've done differently on this machine versus other machines is we don't have a piece of wood with this complicated wiring harness that has to be soldered to all the switches and coils and everything else. Every single thing on our game is designed to be sub-assembly based, which means it's a component that you can pull out of the game, and it's a It's got its own circuit boards. It's got its own wiring. It's got its own mechanical devices. And you can test it. You can operate it. You can assemble it on the side. And then once you're sure it's assembled correctly and working, you can just go attach it to the game, connect it to the main harness, and you're good to go. So we can work with these contract manufacturers, and we can have one building, you know, our wall and scoop, a sub-assembly, and another one building our flipper sub-assembly, or the same one could build all of them or whatever.
Sure.
But yeah, we're not building any of this in our garages. We're not doing any of the assembly ourselves.
In some ways, I mean, looking at watching some of the companies that have designed, quote, boutique games or independent companies, there seems to be this rush of excitement. And I've actually been contacted by a few newer companies that maybe the world doesn't even know about yet, and said, hey, we want to talk about our machine. And I've told all of them sort of like, wait till you have something, because, you know, there's that design rush. There's that the fun. There's, hey, it's pretty. It's colorful. And then there's the big chasm from, hey, I designed something cool, to I'm going to build something cool. Does your game possibly avoid a little bit of that, where, like you said, you can have it built by pieces and you don't have a... I mean, the wiring harness seems to be one of the most difficult parts of a traditional pinball machine.
Yeah, we don't actually have a wiring harness. Every single cable on our system is either point to point or just a very simple, you know, a few connectors on this side and a few connectors on this side. So yes, the assembly process is very different. It's a lot easier. We can literally, and we plan to literally, go to a contract manufacturer who makes cable assemblies and say, we need 1,000 of these with 1 foot length and 4 conductors and a 5-pin header on this side and 1-pin, and they'll just deliver us a box full of cables.
It's a more modern way of building something.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same way they do server racks and everything else. It's just the way things should be designed and built. Now, you brought up an interesting point, though, which is when I talk about our machine, I tell people that we've done all of the manufacturing preparation and all the design of the difficult stuff. And you can do all the fun stuff.
Yeah.
We want people to develop games for the system. We want people not to have to go build ball troughs and cabinets and those things. We want people to take the fun stuff, the art design, the playfield layout, the game rules, the game concepts, and create games for the system. They can literally just do the fun stuff.
Would you sell the company? If somebody walked up to you and said, hey, I'm Gary Byrne, I own a pinball company in, I don't know, Deerfield. Would you sell? I mean, or do you want to see this through? Do you want to be the man who owns the company who's shipping P3 games?
So I've been told I'm stupid or crazy or...
Not by me. I
insane
never said that.
By anyone who I tell them I'm building a machine for the pinball industry, first of all.
Yeah.
But I don't think I am. I think if someone walked up to me with $100 million and said I'm buying your company, I would say, yes, you are, and thank you very much. I mean, there's obviously a number for everything.
Sure.
But
sure.
Realistically, if someone came through with probably what they think is a realistic number, it'll be lower than what I think is a realistic number. Because, I mean, our team knows where we want to take the machine, what our passion is, where we think we can go with it. And we think we can grow a company and take some percentage of the market share and develop this interesting futuristic thing that can grow and adapt. There's certainly a number out there that somebody could come offer me, but they're not going to just buy me out of the pain of taking a machine to manufacturing.
Sure. What's the future hold? You're saying 4 to 6 months to possibly be building machines. Is there an order list right now? Is there an interest list? What is the next 6 months going to hold for you?
Yeah, so we stopped. I mean, we started taking pre-orders a while ago when we announced the game and the machine. Like everybody else was, we kind of wanted to take advantage of the enthusiasm that was in the market 2.5 years ago for pre-ordering machines. And we got a bunch of people to pay us in full for those games. That money, by the way, is still sitting in the bank account. We're not touching it. A couple people have dropped out, but very few relative to what we think is going in the industry. We are taking what we call pre-orders now, but it's more like an interested list. We want people to sign up and tell us that they're interested in a machine, that they are likely going to buy it when it gets to production. We're not taking money anymore. We turned off paid pre-orders. It was about a year ago, I think. And we're just asking people to sign up. Our plan is to get the machine to production. We're going to get the machine to production. And I'm going to keep saying that until I believe it. We're going to get the machine to production. Trey? Yes, we're getting the machine to production. And then at that point, we'll email all the people on our list, and we'll go on the forums and say, listen, we're ready to start taking money for machines that we will build and ship you now. And what that means is we'll take in money from people who want it, and then we'll use that money to buy parts and to pay the contract manufacturers to build those machines.
How frustrating, or I don't know, maybe a better question is, do you feel frustrated, or maybe like the timing was off, as we've seen things like Skippy Pinball and Zidware fall and crash, and you're sort of maybe probably losing a little bit of good faith just because you aren't Stern Pinball? Do you feel that kind of the hurt from that, as you've seen it happen in the smaller company type model? Do you wish you could turn the clock back and be ahead of those guys?
No. I think people building traditional pinball machines, I'll use an example because he's a customer of ours for P-Rock, and he's also a member of our development team. Scott Gullick's working on Wrath of Olympus.
Yep.
His timing was unfortunate for him because he's building a traditional pinball machine with traditional artwork, a traditional layout.
If he'd been 1 year earlier, he'd have sold 150 games
For sure. Yeah. I actually, and I've told our investors this, I've told our internal employees this, that I feel like the things that are going on in the industry is actually really good for our company. Because one, I think a lot of people are working unethically, and I think we're working ethically. And companies like Spooky Pinball are working ethically, and they're not spending customer money on what I call operations and research and development. So we're creating a reputation that we do things correctly. I think we're gaining a lot of trust and support just based on the way we're doing business. But also, I think we're building a different kind of machine that people would buy anyway. I think people will buy traditional machines forever. They'll buy the game that's designed for their favorite movie or their favorite rock band or whatever. But the P3 is a machine that can be so many different things, and if people develop games for it that are interesting, that they're going to want to own one. So I think people, I hope people, will put their game rooms together, pick out whatever games they want based on the theme, and then they will buy a P3 because it will have so many different play options and games, and it's just going to be the machine that people have to own. Of course, that depends on us executing properly and creating at least a first game or two that's really fun, that interests people. But I don't think what's going on in the industry hurts us at all. I mean, I think actually people might get fed up with the bad things that are happening in the industry and move over to the people who are working ethically and seem to take customer feedback and you know, not try to screw them over, or try specifically not to screw them over, and just work that way.
That's well put. We definitely all wish you the best, and we can't wait to see more of the games getting built. I'd like to, at this time, if there's any questions in the room, anything we could cover that we didn't cover, love to open that up. Anybody have anything? Feel free to throw your hand in the air.
We are not ready games in Pascal.
No.
No Pascal.
All right. Well, I would encourage everyone to go play the game, get a feel for it, tell your friends about it, follow the threads on Pinside, follow the website, follow Facebook and Twitter accounts. Jerry, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.